As 1958 progressed, one sensed a new strength, a new dynamism in American life. The 12 months previous to 1958 had been sobering, perplexing, frustrating months. During 1957, the United States had reaped the whirlwind. We had been, for the 10 years since the end of the Second World War, busy curing all the economic ills of other nations. And suddenly, in 1957, we awoke to a splitting financial headache of our own. Little Rock aired much of our dirty linen before the world, much to the delight of those nations who were somewhat tired with our pompous moralizing. During 1957, the Allies announced that they were no longer willing to accept, without protest, without a will of their own, the leadership of the United States. The NATO conference of that year, you will recall that some of them refused to allow American missile bases to be established on their territory. And most of them refused to go along with America's economic and political quarantine of the People's Republic of China. During 1957, we were repaid for our protection of General Nasser during the Suez invasion. We were repaid by a campaign of vituperation and vitriol unparalleled in history. And as 1957 progressed, one sensed that the initiative in the world rested with the Eastern Bloc of nations. And when the first of the Sputniks cruised in orbit over our heads, and when our own overly publicized Vanguard missile lay prostrate at our feet, here in America there was much breast-beating and recrimination. There was the feeling that the Russians had somehow stolen a march on us, that they had tarnished our scientific prestige, and that they had imperiled our national security. And 1957 was a year of reflection, a year of blame-taking and blame-making. But as 1958 moved along, one sensed that America had moved beyond self-pity to action, that we had, with characteristic American vigor, taken off our coats, rolled up our sleeves, and gotten down to work. We met the challenge of the recession head-on. In early spring of last year, employment was at an all-time post-World War II high. Buyer resistance was being met in many industries. Stock inventories were low. There was a great danger that this recession might snowball into a major depression. And as you will recall, during the spring of last year, there was much pessimistic conversation about the extent and the depth of the depression which we were suffering. But America went to work. Businessmen cast their professional eye over procedures of distribution and production, and they worked hard towards making those procedures more economical. Government regulatory agencies dispensed the medicine of lowered interest rates with purposefulness and with intelligence. Union and governmental unemployment compensation funds were ably administered. Local community governments and civic agencies cooperated to sustain a public attitude of optimism and of hope. And by the late fall of this year, those responsible for our economic well-being were pretty well satisfied that America had overcome the worst of the recession and that we were moving into a new era of economic prosperity. America went to work during 1958 in many ways. It went to work in the scientific field. For if the Sputnik had caused us to doubt our scientific competence, our technicians went to work. And as they launched missile after missile from the launching pads of Cape Canaveral, we realized that we were no longer inferior to the other powers of the world in technical know-how, and that if they had stolen a march on us, we would be able in time to close the gap of scientific knowledge which had yawned so wide open between them and between us. And during 1958, we scored a few important scientific triumphs of our own. Our Nautilus atomic-powered submarine cruised under the North Polar ice cap east to west, and its companion, the Sea Wolf, returned the voyage west to east, a voyage of some 1,830 miles, opening up new trade routes and new commercial potentials to man. A missile of the United States, a lunar probe, cruised some 71,000 miles out into the heavens, the furthest to that point which any missile had penetrated the space world. We managed to launch into space an Atlas missile, equal in size to a railroad car, the most weighty of all the nuclear heads which had been pushed out and propelled into space. And during 1958, also, our scientists devised a mechanical methods of reproducing the natural process of photosynthesis, and of giving man thereby the potential in time to harness the power of the sun and to use its vast resources of power for the potential good of man. And if 1959 began with a new and quite astounding success on the part of the Russians in this age of space pioneering, I think that the United States was psychologically and scientifically prepared to admit that this was no longer a catastrophe of major proportions, but rather the expected change and interchange of leadership in spatial competition. We were prepared to recognize that they would at times seem to have the upper hand, and we at times would seem to be able to score the firsts in this spatial competition. During 1958, our scientists had been hard at work, and they had exerted prodigious amounts of energy in order to win back for America a feeling of scientific and technical security. America continued to work also during 1958 in many other ways. We increased by $10 billion our investment in the largest and most extensive cultural and educational system of any country in the world. We continue to support the most beautifully developed and conceived social service agency type of activity which has been conducted at any time in history on a voluntary basis. We went to work to improve our schools, and much was done locally and nationally to make the discipline and the curriculum of the schools more attuned to the requirements and the rigors of the new world. We began and undertook a major program of college scholarships on a national basis, a program much necessary in this era of rising educational costs. We undertook and carried out programs of urban renewal and slum clearance and city planning as we began to blueprint and chart out the development of our own communities to meet the population explosions and the technological advances of the 20th century. All in all, America sobered up, went to work. And if this sobering, this desire to get to work, to be purposeful in our activity, showed itself in many ways during 1958, it showed itself also in a rejection of policies of economic drift and political aimlessness. Because perhaps the most symbolic of all the events which took place domestically during 1958 was the election of last November, a congressional off-year election in which almost 48 million of our people went to the polls and administered to the party in power one of the most crushing votes of no confidence ever administered to an administration. Now, this vote was due to many things. It was due to the recession and to unemployment. It was due to depressed farm prices. It was due to internal Republican bickerings. It was due to the very highly unpopular right-to-work amendment which appeared in certain states. But it was due also, and I think in largest measure, to a rejection of the lack of leadership, the lack of the ability of the present administration to make understandable to the American people the goals towards which we were working, and the means which we must employ to achieve those goals. The Democratic Party during the last election was unwilling or unable to set out into blueprint a new formula for American life. And so we must set down this election route simply to a rejection of the lack of leadership, the lack of positive accomplishment in the programs of the current administration. Certainly, the unwillingness of our president to exert energetic leadership, despite his good intentions and his goodwill, certainly this unwillingness to exert vital leadership in a vital age, to make hard decisions when hard decisions were required, certainly this was a requirement which the American people felt a president must accept, and one which many groups in the American people felt he had not adequately shouldered. And if our Secretary of State had made many decisions, somehow these decisions had not been blessed with happy fruition, with victory in the diplomatic sphere. And though he had done much global touring, and though he had visited many nations and made many contacts with foreign dignitaries, somehow he had not been able to make real and understandable to the American people the purpose of all this activity, the purpose of all these commitments, the purpose of all the billions of dollars which we were spending for foreign aid, the purpose of all the conventions which we were undertaking with nations throughout the world. We rejected during 1958, we the American people, rejected a lackluster leadership, a leadership by indirection, a leadership which seemed to lack the will to meet head-on the serious, difficult obstacles which Americans faced domestically and in foreign affairs during very difficult and trying days. Now, during 1958, America was faced with grave challenges at home and abroad. We had a major crime problem here at our hands in almost all the thickly populated urban areas. Crime was on the rise, crimes of violence especially were beginning to frighten our people. And the American cities were faced with a major program of crime prevention, one which is still only in its infancy. And in the south of our land, we were faced with what has become the endemic problem of racial tension, of violence by those who refuse to accept the majesty and the dominion of the American dream and of the American law. In the South, our problem took two forms during the year 1958. On the school issue itself, it took the form of the closing of the schools in Norfolk, Charlottesville, and Warren County in Virginia, in Little Rock in Arkansas. The courts had ordered specifically the integration of schools in these communities. And following a program of massive resistance, the governors of Virginia and of Arkansas had ordered the schools to be closed and had made some 16,400 of our younger citizens pay the price of their political demagoguery and of their mature prejudices. Over 1 million school days have been lost by these 16,400 young people. It's a tragedy of major proportions. In an age when America requires the most talented, trained leadership available, an age when even the act of citizenship itself requires a breadth and extent of knowledge requiring deep study and learning. For governors of two of our sovereign states to deny, because of their prejudices and for no other reason, the right to a public education to some 16,000 of their young people, to deny to the American people the trained minds which these youngsters represent. This was a problem of the first magnitude with which America had to come to grips and had not yet, as the new year began, come to grips. For these schools were still closed on January 1. and the makeshift private school systems which had been established were manifestly inadequate. And next year there would be new orders by the courts for the integration of further school systems. This was a challenge which the new American energy, the new American desire to be purposeful next in this activity, would have to meet head on in 1959. And secondly, during 1958, we were met with an outbreak of acts of terrorism, of acts of incendiarism, with acts of violence. There were 28 major bombings or attempted bombings of public institutions in the South during the year 1958. The junior high school at Osage, West Virginia, was demolished. The senior high school at Clinton, Tennessee, was badly damaged. The Jewish Community Center in Jacksonville, Florida, was badly damaged. The home of a university professor of the Louisiana State University was demolished. The Mount Zion Methodist Church in Nashville, Tennessee, was bombed. The Reformed Congregation in Atlanta had its educational wing badly damaged. These and many other acts of terrorism were carried out by a group of neo-fascist lunatics reminiscent of the Bundes of the pre-World War II movements, reminiscent of the Ku Klux Klan of the post-World War days, a small inbred group of bigots who, encouraged by the defiance of the law on the part of the lawmakers in the South, undertook to carry out an actionist, violent policy aimed at destroying all those elements in the American society which they personally contemned and condemned. It is interesting to note that men of goodwill decried these acts, obviously, of violence, and decried the closing of the schools in 1958. They decried similar acts of violence and similar closings of schools in 1957, 1956. And if that had only been that preachers and thinkers throughout America were speaking out against these policies of interposition, of massive resistance, of violence, these policies based on prejudice, then we could not say that during 1958 America took a step forward. And yet she did. Because during 1958, for the first time, the average people in these communities began to undertake positive policies to meet the challenge which bigotry and demagoguery had placed before them. In Norfolk, the Norfolk School Board petitioned Governor Ammon not to close the school systems. And when he persisted in carrying out his policy, they went to the courts to try and thwart his program. In a recent election in Little Rock, three of the six members elected to the Little Rock School Board stood in direct opposition to Governor Faubus. And they were pledged to a program of opening the schools at any price, even if integration is a necessary prerequisite. And in the South during the year 1958, Mayor Hayden Burns of Jacksonville organized a Southern Conference on Bombing, which was an organization of law enforcement agencies from all the southern communities undertaken to correlate and to draw together all known information about known terrorists, known Klanists, known Knights of the White Camellia, known anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic, anti-Negro actionist groups, to make this information available to any local agency requiring it in its detection. And throughout the South, leaders of all the faiths and of all the races raised their voices as one to set the climate of opinion against these acts of lawlessness and of terrorism. And finally, after the October bombing of the Atlanta Temple, our federal government for the first time actively intervened and speedily brought to trial five of the men allegedly responsible for this action. Nationally and locally, action was being taken as the old year closed to bring an end to the extremes of this program of prejudice and bigotry and to reassert the dominion of law and of right throughout our land. But the outbreaks of violence served only to point up the large way, what our American primitives would call the fur path, which the American people must follow if they are to achieve domestically the kind of life which we desire. For if we have achieved the end of the recession, we have not yet solved the problems of a corrosive inflation, which in 20 years since 1939 has reduced the purchasing power of our dollar by 53%. And if we have brought about a return to an increasingly productive society, we have not yet been able to prove that the new high costs of labor and of service will enable us to compete favorably in foreign markets. We have not yet been able to devise assurances that we will be able to meet the challenge of foreign competition. And if we have undertaken programs to tighten up our public school system, we have not yet proven that we are willing to be consistent in this program, to make it a long-range, an important, vital one. And if we have undertaken programs of slum clearance and urban renewal, we have not yet come to grips with a larger problem of social stratification in our cities, in those artificial barriers, these restrictions which prevent minority groups of race or color or religion from inhabiting in whatever areas of the city they may seek to settle. These and many other problems confront America as the new year begins. But the new willingness of the American people to get down to work, to be up and to be doing, this new spirit, this new surge of the American pulse, augurs well for tomorrow. The vital test, of course, will come in the field of foreign affairs. 1958 was not an auspicious year, as 1957 had not been an auspicious year, as 1956 had not been an auspicious year in the area of foreign affairs. We scored no signal victories. We suffered a few rather disastrous defeats. Our foreign policy was based on continuing programs of the military containment of Russia, of the erection of a series of military alliances through Europe, in the Near East and Asia, aimed at that containment, at the reunification of Germany, the reestablishment of the sovereignty of Chiang Kai-shek over the mainland of China, at the winning over of the feudal lords and the new rulers of the Arab Near East in order to win for the West the richness of their oil, and towards a rather patronizing but somewhat helpful attitude towards our Latin American and South American neighbors. But as 1958 progressed, we saw evidence after evidence that these old principles of national policy were no longer viable 10 years after they had been promulgated. The policy of military alliances aimed at the containment of Russia was shown to be weak when Iraq, the only nation in the Near East which had joined in the Baghdad Pact, the only consistently pro-Western country in that area, in July of last year, suffered a revolution which overthrew the Pahlavi monarchy and reestablished the rule of a military junta headed by General Qasem. Iraq in 1958 in January had been the bastion, the bulwark on which we based the Baghdad Pact in the Near East. In January of 1959, we were timid and afraid that Russian influence would again be reasserted in Iraq. Russian aid had already there been received, and local communist parties were already there active in and out of the government. The question of the appeasement of the Arab world again was in the forefront of most minds. It might have been thought that we had learnt our lesson well during the previous years and would no longer follow an appeasement of General Nasser and of his megalomaniac ambitions. As 1958 began, we knew full well that he was grasping for power, that he aimed to overwhelm whatever sovereignties stood in his way. And we knew well that the United Arab Republic was infiltrated by Russian groups. The Syrian army was commanded by communist sympathizing and communist believing generals. During the year of 1958, we had no reason to change our attitude and our mind towards General Nasser. In Tunisia and the Sudan, prodigious efforts had to be undertaken by these countries simply to keep pro-Nasser groups from overthrowing legitimate governments. Only the intervention of American troops in July and of English troops in Jordan and Lebanon prevented the swallowing of these midget states by the United Arab Republics. Throughout the year, Cairo radio continued to broadcast an avalanche, a torrent of anti-American diatribe. By the end of the year, American, British, German, and Italian administrators were in Cairo seeking to give General Nasser aid on his Aswan Dam project, governmental support, freeing his currencies, buying again his cotton. But thinking people questioned what Iraq and what Egypt meant as far as the consistent philosophy of American policy. If we depended for our military alliances on areas as weak as the government of Iraq, and if we depended on appeasement on reeds as broken as General Nasser, could our policies hope in the long range to be worthy of achieving any desirable goal? And moving into the area of the Far East, we suffered here also we recognized here a need to reconsider the basic American philosophy of foreign affairs. In September of 1958, guns from the shores of the People's Republic of China began to blast out against Quemoy and against Matsu. And though we had long since recognized that there was little hope, if any, of General Chiang Kai-shek's ever being reestablished as the government of China, a series of 10-year-old commitments brought us in September very close to the brink of a major Sino-American war. And again, Americans questioned whether now was not a propitious time for reassessment. General and President Syngman Rhee, during the December of last year, also did the American cause in Asia a grave disservice. We had spent 3 years of battle, spilling American blood to save his little nation from North Korean and Chinese invasion. He was to be, under our Egypt and with our aid, a symbol of the meaning of democratic government throughout the Asian world. In December of this year, at gunpoint, he pushed through his General Assembly, his parliament, a new constitution, which in effect made him the virtual absolute dictator of South Korea. All vestiges of democracy were destroyed, were torn aside, and the Asian world looked on, I'm sure, somewhat askance and somewhat sniggering at this disciple of American democracy, at this bastion of American democracy throughout the Far East. Europe during 1958 was prosperous. Its currency was sound, so sound that by the end of 1958, they were able to make these currencies convertible for the first time since the end of the Second World War. France experimented with strong central leadership and gambled on the life and the person of General de Gaulle to bring them the kind of strong government which they had lacked for many years. But American policy in Europe continued to be based preeminently on a program to reunify Germany. And the policy of the East German government and the Soviet Union obviously was based on the opposite precept of sustaining the division of East and West Germany. And they continuously put America on the defensive. By the end of the year, we were forefaced in Berlin with a crisis of major proportions. Russia had told us that by June 1st, we must end the military occupation of Berlin And in all probability, the reason for this lies in the desire of the East German government to gain for itself recognition from the West and stability. Most experts seem to feel that this program, this threat to American life, this threat of war, will be solved long before June 1st. But it served to remind Americans again that a central principle on which we had based our post-war policy had brought us to the precipice of a third world war, and perhaps was no longer meaningful as a principle of foreign policy in the next decade ahead. So 1958 was a year in which Americans were forced to think clearly and think rather candidly about the principles on which their foreign policy was being based. And if the architects of American policy were unwilling to change the direction of their activities, there grew up in America a groundswell of protest. Men and women of significance and of position, men and women who could not be silenced by being decried as communist and communist sympathizers, men and women representing all the religious branches of American life, who spoke out for a policy based not on war but on peace, not on containment of Russia but on the possibility of peaceful coexistence in one world with Russia. I had occasion several weeks ago to read to you the text of the China statement of the World Order movement, which met here in Cleveland. The World Order Study Group was a group of 600 leading representatives of the National Council of Churches of Christ, which is the overall body of most of the Protestant churches in America. In closing that statement, speaking now not so much of the Chinese program, but of their views on foreign policy in general, this very important group in American life had this to say: stronger efforts should be made to break through the present stalemate and to find ways of living with the communist nations. Sometimes this is called coexistence, but we are concerned with something more than the minimum meaning of the word. Our relationship with the communist nations should combine competition between ways of life with cooperation for limited objectives. Our resistance to communist expansion goes with recognition of the fact that communist nations are nations, have their own legitimate interests and their own reasonable fears. We should avoid the posture of general hostility and cease the practice of continual moral lectures to them by our leaders. In the Cold War, we allow ourselves to drift into offensive, defensive positions in which we hesitate to admit any imperfections in our society, lest it seem to confirm the communist indictment. Thus, we inhibit the self-criticism which is essential to the health of a democracy. We tend to make opposition to communism the touchstone for policy, both in domestic life and in international relations. There is real hope that new generations within the communist countries will be less fanatic in their ideological convictions, that they will be more preoccupied with peace, with economic well-being, and with tentative experiments in cultural freedom than in the attempt to dominate other nations. It is not to be expected that they will formally renounce what we consider to be their errors. It is enough for the kind of living together described above if their emphasis and priorities change. The establishment of good relations will require tireless negotiations with them, and imaginative programs of communication, cultural exchange, and personal contact. Vigilance and realistic precautions are necessary, but cognition about the good of all of each of on each one of these counts, but unwillingness to recognize any good in each other is a poisonous atmosphere in which to try to conduct negotiations. It is not enough to deplore war and to call for its abolition. We must engage and encourage our country to engage without reservation in the things that make for peace. This is an important statement by an important group of our fellow citizens. And I would parallel this statement by the conclusion of an essay written in the important Catholic magazine Commonweal by Professor Donald Brandon of the Department of History of the University of San Francisco. Because I think you will see, coming from an entirely different religious orientation, much of the same spirit. On all the forefronts of the Cold War, military, diplomatic, economic, and psychological, the Soviet regime has the initiative. And the US-led free world is on the defensive. America has used poorly the non-military instruments of foreign policy. Allies and neutrals are losing confidence in the American capacity to deal with the complex challenges of the communist bloc and of the contemporary world. James Burnham was as right in his criticism of the negative character of containment as he was wrong in his advocacy of a policy of liberation. Containment, both in theory and practice, is essentially a policy of reaction to Soviet pressure. This policy, followed by the United States, leaves the initiative in the hands of the communist bloc and places the free world in the position of responding to Soviet moves at times and places chosen by the Russians. It is almost inevitable that such a policy should degenerate into mere anti-communism in the hands of the present administration, for its leaders from President Eisenhower on down have shown little or no conception of a positive foreign policy. For the age of conflict, which began in 1914 and which has not yet run its course, this age is a transitional one in which an old order is passing and a new order is struggling to be born. Moreover, the technological revolution of our time has made possible the creation of one world for the first occasion in history. The basic issue is whether the nations and peoples of the world shall be united by force or by consent. Either the communist bloc will succeed in organizing a world despotism, or America will lead the nations toward a free, pluralist association which represents the religions, cultures, and legitimate political and economic interests of the peoples of the world. No one can be certain that mankind will escape the dreaded nuclear catastrophe, but the ever-present possibility of that conflagration and the necessity of military preparedness dare not deter the United States from the positive diplomatic and positive economic policies which are indispensable to the wrestling of the initiative from the communist bloc in our contemporary world. The United States would not need to fear the communist capture of the genuine revolutions which are taking place in the underdeveloped nations of the world if America reassumed its traditional role as the leader of the positive revolution in world affairs. In short, America needs to be strong not only in arms but in principle. We need to stand not only for military preparedness, but for moral rectitude. We need to embark on a policy which is designed not so much at the military containment of our potential enemies, but at the moral preparation of the American people for life in the 20th century. We need to be prepared, yes. We need to be prepared for our own domestic problems. We need to be prepared for a world of coexistence, a world in which we shall continue to live as we now live, with many nations ideologically far from our own point of view, culturally far distant from our own cultural norms, and yet willing to exchange ideas with us, willing to exchange trade and cultural missions with us, willing to sit down with us at bargaining tables time and time again, to hammer out accommodations which will make possible a world of peace, a world of plenty, and a world of progress. I think that this upsurge of opinion in America requiring a more positive and flexible foreign policy will be heard during the coming year, because it is a basic groundswell surge. Represents the clearest thinking, I think, of the leadership in America. Whether this surge will bring us peace or war, of course, no one can tell. Peace requires the will of all parties in our world to establish peace. We have no reason to believe as yet that the Russians' protestations of peaceful intent are genuine. And yet I submit to you that we have really no reason to disbelieve their being genuine. Perhaps we stand closer to world accommodation than we now know. Soviet Deputy Premier Mikoyan will be in Washington for talks which obviously have to do with a settlement of some of the world tensions. Premier Khrushchev addressed a very beautifully written New Year's message to the American people in which he spoke of the intent of the Russian people to live side by side with our own in a world at peace. And I found in the New York Times of yesterday this very interesting report of an article written by the Russian propagandist Ilya Ehrenberg in the Soviet newspaper Svetskaya Russia just 2 days ago. And if it represents the thinking of the leadership in Russia, we have no way of knowing, but if it does, then perhaps we are closer to a world of peace than any of us dare hope or pray. Article begins as follows. What is a thinking Russian to think at the end of another year of Cold War? At least one thinks that there is hope. Ilya Ehrenberg, novelist and occasionally a newspaper correspondent, attracted wide attention here today with a long essay containing a demonstration of candor and an attempt at understanding. Here is the essence of what he told his countrymen in the columns of Sovetskaya Russia. The Soviet people have accomplished much, but a great deal remains to be done. There are strange contrasts in the Soviet society, contrasts between bold pioneers and lazy laggards, between shiny jet planes and poor household utensils, between contractors digging up wastelands and a shortage of gardening tools, between an indisputable triumph over illiteracy and the absence of a literary match for the Russian greats of 100 years ago. Much remains to be done to overcome the cult of form among bureaucrats and neglect of form by artists. And I might say that we might find parallels to all of these oppositions in our own American life. But to accomplish, he continues, what must be accomplished, the Soviet people, like all people, need peace. Recent events may seem to leave little room for hope, but there is hope. Much has been changed for the better among us, and changes have taken place abroad as well. Besides diplomats and generals, there exist people. And the seeming change of public opinion in the United States is most encouraging. Russians speak a lot about American monopolies, and it is true that they play a big role in American life, but so do the wishes of tens of millions of ordinary Americans. Life in the United States is strange, not easily summarized or understandable, for the United States is a young as well as a big, rich, and energetic country. Its mighty technology developed faster than its caution. Comfort was valued higher than duty, and tremendous success led to complacency and to the belief that the American way of life was better than anything else. But, said Mr. Ehrenberg, Americans have no militarist tradition. They can fight, but they are not bellicose. Why then do so many not only tolerate but really support the Cold War out of fear? Communism is so strange to people accustomed to have even water and gas and electricity controlled by monopolies that they are confounded by socialist society. When politicians start proving that the Soviet system threatens the whole world, the Americans approve military measures that seem to be logical precautions. The bad thing was that some Americans began to dream of giving the whole world their way of life and became convinced that sooner or later they would have to liberate the Russians from the Reds. But the worst facet of the Cold War, the spy mania and the witch hunts, are over in the United States. Hundreds of visitors to the Soviet Union without approving of communism can see that the Soviet order is firm, that Russians want to build up their country and do not want to attack anyone, and that trade and exchange with Russians are possible. For one of the key Russian publicists to make this analysis of the American scene, to see these possibilities for world coexistence. It's perhaps one of the, and for his speech to be allowed to be printed in an official Russian publication, it's perhaps one of the most optimistic indications that we can have. The possibilities of working out our mutual differences will be made available to us during the coming year. And that if we remain strong and prepared, and if we remain courageous and willing to sit down and to hammer out conventions settling the major outstanding difficulties of the world, if we are not myopic in our view and unwilling to come to grips with any of the major issues which now confront and confound the world, if, in short, there are not only words of peace, but a desire and a will for peace expressed in American policy, I am mildly optimistic that 1959 will bring us closer to that great day when every man shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and though every man may not agree with his neighbor, none of them need be afraid. Amen.